welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. In one of our most popular recent podcasts, I spoke with Mary Manning of Elliston Capital, who manages the Elliston Asian Investments listed investment company. In that conversation, her insights about India as a growth opportunity for your portfolio were so fascinating, we felt they deserved a conversation all of their own. By way of introduction, Mary has a PhD in economics and has managed money for Oaktree in New York and Singapore and Soros of George Soros fame in New York as well. She's been investing in Asia and India for over 20 years, so quite a tough act to follow for all of us. Mary, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me, Gemma.
So Mary, in our last conversation, you raised some fascinating statistics about India and the powerhouse you believe it already is, and it's likely to become. Can you talk us through those?
Sure. So I guess the first important thing to highlight about India is the demographics. So people are aware that China is a huge country, but people don't realize that India also has 1.2 billion people. And that's almost 50 times the population of Australia. And by 2030, it's estimated that the Indian population, because of growth rates, will be actually bigger than the Chinese population. So India is a huge country, and it's getting really too big to ignore from an investing perspective. The other thing to highlight about demographics is that they're very, very attractive in India. So a lot of Asian countries have aging populations. India is the opposite. 65% of the population is under the age of 35. So if you're looking for, and they have almost over 400 million millennials. So if you're looking for a big consumer market, people who are growing up and they're getting their first job and they need to buy a car and they want to buy a home and they want to upgrade the kind of consumer products that they buy, India is a fantastic market for that rising middle class story. One of the other reasons we really like India right now is because of the structural reform. So we talked about a bit about this in the previous podcast, but structural reform is basically a lot of the things that Prime Minister Modi has done since he was elected in 2014. So this is a huge infrastructure build, demonetization, which was that whole program where you change in the old money for the new money, and it was intended to get rid of corruption. In terms of housing for all, electricity for all, a lot of these things that he's trying to, penetrate to the lower parts of the economy with different goods. So Modi has done a lot in terms of structural reform. We think that's going to continue. I guess the third reason I really like India as an investor who's looking for stocks who are going to benefit from all this is the under-penetration of key sectors. So what this means is, if you look at banking, for example, in Australia, household debt to disposable income is over 100%. In India, it's 9%. If you look at the number of people who have credit cards, it's very, very tiny. If you look at the number of people who have mortgages, it's tiny. If you just extend that up to the level where even China is, let alone where the US and Australia is, there are decades left of growth for some of these products. I mean, autos is another example that I like to use in terms of underpenetrated micro stories. So, car ownership in India, for every 1,000 people, there's only 32 cars. That same number in the US and Australia is around 800. So again, that could double and triple and quadruple, and you still wouldn't even be at a developed country level. So we think for goods like that, there's a really, really long runway in terms of the growth potential. The combination of all these things, the demographics, the structural reform, the underpenetrated micro stories, the sum of all that is that India has turned into a very, very high growth market. And as you know from following Australian investments very closely, Australia is not a high growth economy. Mm. It's very, very difficult to find growth in Australia. In India, it's the opposite. If you have an economy that's growing at 7.6%, that's the GDP growth, or 7.4%, excuse me, that's the GDP growth in India right now, it is very easy to find companies that are growing at 10% EPS growth. It's actually still pretty easy to find companies that are growing at 20% EPS growth. And I can't think of very many other economies in the world where it is easy to find big, high-quality, well-managed companies that are growing at 20%. So that's why we like India right now.
That's a spectacular summary. It seems like such a strong story. Can we start with the structural reforms? Because that's quite important for people to understand. A lot of developing countries, local investors can be quite anxious about going there, and it's relatively new from an investment perspective for them. But structural reforms made a really big difference to the appeal of India. Can you talk us through some of that?
Yeah, so as you said at the beginning, I have been investing in India for a long time. I first invested in India in 2002, 2003. And there was a lot of time, in those intervening 15, 16 years where India was not an attractive market, I'll be honest. There still were some returns, but the political leadership was pretty lackluster. A lot of the things that obviously needed to be done in India, like infrastructure build, were just not getting done. It was highly bureaucratic. There was different policies like import substitution, which had currency implications, which were unfavorable. So really what happened, though, when Prime Minister Modi came in, he had a very, very clear game plan. And he said, this is what I'm going to do. He was also previously the chief minister in Gujarat state. And when he was there, he had very, very good execution capabilities. So people were quite confident that when he got in, he said, this is what I'm going to do. And he also had the credentials to say, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to be able to execute it properly. So some of the things he's done, like I said before, a big one was demonetization. And so what he wanted to do there was get rid of all the black money in the economy. So he said it was a surprise. This, you know, it has to be a surprise, otherwise these things won't work. You know, as of a certain date, all the old money had to be put into the bank, and then you were issued with new notes. And that was, you know, to clean out the black money. But that has had a really positive unintended consequence in that there were a lot of people in the Indian economy who had money under the mattress. And when they had to take it into the bank to change it, they put it in the bank and they just left it there. They weren't going to take the new notes out and put it back under the mattress. And so as a result of this, a lot of that money has now started flowing into the stock market. So if you look at returns, India has been one of the best performing stock markets recently. Even year to date, it's up 8%. So a lot of the other markets in the whole world are either flat to down. India's up 8%, and that's financial year to date in the last 2 months. So India's performing very well. So that demonetization was one of the structural reform things. Another big thing is GST. So you probably heard in the olden days, people used to always complain about how bureaucratic India was, and there's all these different states, and they all have different tax regimes, and it's so hard to get anything done. So what GST intended to do was to harmonize all these tax rates so that for companies now, you know, it's much, much easier to do business. It also sort of cleaned up a lot of the black economy or the informal economy, because everybody has to pay GST now, and so you can't have anyone in your the chain of your business that's not a legitimate business, otherwise you don't get the receipts for the GST. So it's really acted to formalize the economy, and that's quite good for us as equity investors, because obviously if you're listed equity, you're part of the formal economy, and it's just made the economy much more productive. And then there's things like, as I said, Bharatmala is a big highway infrastructure build project, which is really important. I don't know if you've been to India, but we go to India a lot. Me and all of my team, you know, we're on the ground probably 3 or 4 times a year. Sometimes if you need to go to a meeting that's, you know, 100 kilometers outside one of the big cities, it'll take you 4.5 hours to get there because the road infrastructure is so bad. Modi has realized this and realized it's a productivity drag on the country, and so there's big infrastructure build going on. And then there's also things like housing for all. Again, housing is an issue in India, electricity for all. So really he's done more, in my opinion, than any other elected leader in the last 4 years to really move India to the next level.
It sounds incredibly powerful as a development stream, and that's very rapid change, and it seems like it's been incredibly effective. I was telling you before we started recording, and I'll throw it in there as an anecdote. Modi was in Australia a few years back, so he was Prime Minister at that point in time. He'd come to Australia, I'm not sure what for. My father works in biotechnology, and he went to my father's lab. He was quite interested in the work they're doing, their work on tropical crops, and spent time in the lab understanding the technology. So he's obviously a bit of an unusual guy for a head of state. That's not terribly common.
Yes, absolutely, and very, very impressive, again, in terms of what he's been able to execute.
Yeah, just powerful. And obviously that matters a lot when you're an investor. You need to have confidence that the governance framework is right. You've got a head of state who's driving that activity. That makes a big difference. So most NABTrade investors, most of the people who listen to this podcast, they really understand the growth story of China. Many are attempting to get access to that growth story through both international and domestic companies. I could almost guarantee they can't name a single large cap Indian stock. So that story is just not playing out anywhere near as strongly. What are some of the big names you like?
Okay, so it's a very good point. People say to me quite often is that, oh my goodness, I don't even know any Indian stocks at all. When I say, you know, India is going to be the third largest economy in the world by 2030, can you name any Indian stocks? And they're like, maybe they would know HDFC, maybe they would know Infosys or TCS, but probably Tata Motors, some people know. But really, it's the field is wide open. So maybe I'll just comment a little bit in terms of you know, why people need exposure to these specific companies. Mm. I mean, as I said before, they are high growth and they are excellent management teams. I think this is one sort of misconception. But I had a friend who was very interested in, he's a fellow investor in Australia, but he'd never been to India before. He asked me to, you know, set him up with a conference. So I sent him to this conference, which is generally well regarded. And he came back and he said, those are some of the best management teams I've ever met in the world.
Wow.
And India is a, you know, it's a high growth market, but it's also a very high return market. Mm. People are shocked to know that the average of our Indian investments, the average ROE is 20%. So that is a really high, that is a very high ROE. So when you're getting high growth and high returns, that's an attractive market characteristic. So back to your original question, some of the names that we like, one is Maruti Suzuki. People may have heard of this. It's the largest passenger company car in all of India. And it's very high quality company. It's growing around 19% EPS growth. So again, that's, you know, three, four, five times what you're getting in sort of Australian consumer land. And you know, the PE is not that expensive. It's around one times PEG, and you know, $50+ billion market cap company. Another company that we like is Larsen & Toubro. So it's called L&T is sort of its nickname. So L&T is the largest infrastructure company in India. And all the things I said before in terms of structural reform, infrastructure is clearly a beneficiary of all those. Mm-hmm. So that's why we like L&T. We've held it for quite a while. HDFC is a name that some people may have heard before. It's the largest mortgage financer in India. And HDFC is an absolutely fascinating company. I've held it on and off for over 15 years now. It's a structural growth story. So it just grows every year, you know, 15%. It's extremely well managed. It's never blown up. It's highly capitalized, very high quality management. So one of the reasons that I like that stock, if you think about what I said before in terms of mortgage penetration, it is very, very low in India. And the government, I also mentioned about housing for all. If you put those two things together, the government is pushing for people to have houses, and you know, housing mortgage penetration is very low. There is a really you know, strong and long-lasting demand for mortgages in India. So HDFC is a company that I like. And then lastly, Hindustan Unilever. You've probably heard the Unilever part, maybe not the Hindustan part
the
at the front.
Combination is not familiar to me.
So Hindustan Unilever is Unilever's business in India. And we really like this story because in terms of the Indian consumer, they're not all created equally, right? You have people who live in rural villages who are quite low income, and you have ultra high net worth people who live in Delhi and Mumbai and are sort of global consumers. And Hindustan Unilever, they sell, you know, little shampoo packets that are, you know, the size of your palm. And their idea is if, you know, someone's buying one of those a week, we want to sell them two a week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the growth that they can get from that sort of lower end consumer is absolutely amazing. And they're also a big beneficiary of what I talked about before in terms of the formalization of the economy. In, you know, certain parts of India, people will just go to the market and buy stuff in a bag. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's becoming more difficult with the GST. So now you go to a proper supermarket and buy stuff from Hindustan Unilever. So those are some of the companies that we like in India.
Question without notice, but it feels in a very rapidly developing country where people are being lifted out of poverty very rapidly, there's quite a bit of potential for impact investing. Is that something that you think about as you choose the companies that you go for? Or is it more just the growth rate is exceptional and they're doing what they do well?
So we do look at ESG characteristics, but we are a screen out. We're not impact investors, but we're screen out. Mm. So we look at a lot of companies, and as long as they meet our ESG criteria, which is very high, and it's quite a difficult hurdle to jump over, mm-hmm. then they get in the portfolio. But what I will say is that, you know, a company that we owned recently, it was called Murat Financial Inclusion, and it was a microfinance lender. Mm. And it, you know, gave really small loans, like small number of rupees, you know, $50 loans to women in Indian villages. And, you know, then they all sort of agree to pay back. If one woman can't pay back, then the other women agree to pay back for her. And this was an absolutely amazing company. So their NPLs and their delinquencies were infinitesimal because of the structure of this business. And I was actually really disappointed because I was supposed to go out to this village, it was about 5 hours outside Bangalore, to visit one of their branches out there and meet with the women. And then it was the day after demonetization happened. And they called me and they said, I'm sorry, this is a complete, it's not a crisis, but frankly, we have better things to worry about
not
than taking into the village. But there are companies like that. We don't invest in them purposely, but you can see that they are making a really big impact in terms of poverty reduction in India.
That's incredibly exciting. I went through university when Grameen Bank stories were incredibly important, and economic development stories around microfinance were were really what everyone was focusing on. So it's fascinating to see sometime later that that is still, you know, a powerful investing opportunity as well as an impact opportunity.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about that story is that that company actually got taken over by a really big bank, because the big banks were saying, actually, this microfinance thing is you know, a fantastic opportunity, and it brings people into our you know, relationship. It forms a relationship with us at a certain stage, and we want those relationships. So yeah, it got taken over at a decent premium. So I was happy with that investment.
Worked out all the way across the board. You were quoted in a really big piece recently in the Financial Review talking about structural reform under Prime Minister Modi, so the things that we've been talking about. Are you concerned if he loses the upcoming elections that those reforms are going to stall, or they're going to be wound back at all? Is that a risk for investors?
So it definitely is a risk. The elections and the political situation is something that we're watching quite closely. As Gemma said, there is a general election coming up in 2019. It's roughly slated for May 2019. And you know, similar to Australia, there are state elections that happen not at the same time as the general election. So people are always watching the state elections to see if this is giving them any clues. And the most recent state election was in Karnataka in the south. And Congress was expected to win, but then BJP is Modi's party, was gaining in the polls. And then when they actually did lose, people were a little bit disappointed. And then Congress went into coalition. Nobody had a majority, but Congress went into coalition with a smaller party to form a majority, and now they are the government in Karnataka. So some people after that election started to worry that a similar thing could play out on the national stage, where Modi's personal popularity is very, very high. Mm. If they do these polls saying, do you like Prime Minister Modi, it's like 75% of people think he's great. But obviously statistically that's not the right way to do it, because you're eliciting responses from people who already like him. Mm. Nevertheless, overall Modi's personal responsibility or popularity is very high. But sometimes, because of these non-linearities with the Congress party and different coalition parties, you could end up with a weird result. Mm. So my base case is that BJP stays in power, either as a majority or as a minority. Mm. And in that case, I think the structural reforms would continue. If it was a minority government, it would be slightly harder to implement, but I think they'll continue. The other case to consider is, okay, what happens if they lost altogether and Congress came in, Congress and coalition parties? In that case, I think the structural reforms would definitely slow down. Mm. But my view, again, having covered India for a long time, is that the train has left the station. So there's the train is not going to grind to a halt and start moving backwards towards the station. It's on its way, and sometimes it's going to be going really fast, sometimes it's going to be going moderately fast, but I think, you know, the development story of India is already on its way, and the change in government is not going to have a massive impact on it.
That's encouraging. As I mentioned, most investors would have no direct contact with the Indian stock market, unless they happen to be Indian, in which case we do have quite a few Indian investors who use NabTrade who are based here. How stable is the Indian stock market itself? Often there can be a bit of a disconnect in developing countries between the economy and the stock market. Is it well regulated? Is it pretty safe for foreign investors?
Well, I guess I'll start by saying it's very, very difficult for investors to access directly. So it's not, you know, you mentioned in a previous podcast where NAB trade investors can invest directly.
Yeah, I'm not Indian's at all surprised. Not one of those markets.
And so I hear that a lot from people. We even have very, very sophisticated investors who have said to us, in all other markets in the world, I do it direct. Family offices who say, every single other market in the world, we do direct. India, can't do it. And so that's obviously you know, great for us, because we do have all the, you know, we can trade directly in India. So it's not a DIY market. If you want exposure to India, you're going to have to do it via someone else. In terms of the market being safe, you know, so obviously there's the National Stock Exchange of India and the Bombay Stock Exchange. I've never had any problems investing in those at all. And the returns sort of speak for themselves. So on a 20-year basis, you will never guess how much of the Sensex, that's the main Indian index, is up on a 20-year basis.
Tell me.
Over 1,000%. Australia.
So everyone's always talking about the 10X, and it turns out the 10X is India.
The 10X is India. So, you know, Australia over that same period is up around roughly 140. So it is, you know, it's in my opinion, I've never had any problems with the stock exchange. It can be bureaucratic, and that's probably why it's not a DIY market. But in terms of the returns, I think they speak for themselves whether India's a good market or not.
And they're very much reflecting what's going on in the population and in the economy.
Yeah.
So on that, a lot of our investors who are looking for markets where they can see the growth profile but obviously can't access it themselves, or they're not confident, they'll buy an ETF for exposure. What are your thoughts on that for India specifically? We've talked about it for Asia, but let's talk about India.
So I'd make a similar comment in terms of, you know, India is not it's a developing country, and there still are a lot of information asymmetries, and so there is definitely room for stock picking. I guess the other thing is we feel very, very comfortable in large caps. So we, across the Asia Fund and in India, we only own large cap companies. So the smallest market cap we own in India is probably around 20 billion. And companies like Reliance and TCS, these are, you know, $150 billion companies in Aussie dollar terms. And so it's really important to stay in the large cap end of town, I think, where you do get, and this is across Asia, I think this is actually across the world, where you get issues in terms of governance are generally in the smaller caps and in the smaller part of smaller caps. Mm-hmm. So we think that by staying in large caps, very well run, high quality management that we know, proven track record, this is the best place to be. With an ETF, you're not 100% sure what you're getting, and there could be some stuff at the, you know, at that bottom end, the long tail of the index that you definitely don't want to own.
So on that also, we talked in the previous podcast, but I didn't ask specifically about India, how well it's represented. So making that comment, you know, third largest economy in the world, it's an enormous country, so much going on, how well it is actually represented in the world indices that people will buy. So if you say, you know, right, I'm just going to get global growth, right, I'm just going to buy the world. Where's India in that?
Yeah, so India is shockingly unrepresented in the in global indices. So I'll tell you a funny story. We were doing a presentation about India one time, and the slice of the pie in the pie chart in the presentation was so small, we couldn't get the stick properly attached to it.
It's just a line.
And so the person who was doing the presentation was like, should we just make that a bigger number so that it looks a bit bigger and we can attach the stick? And I said, this is ridiculous. The representation is so small, we literally can't even represent it properly. So we had to do one of those pie charts where the little stick comes out and then we can.
Anyway, it's a little piece of pie.
Exactly. So even visually, India is very underrepresented. So if you have a global fund that tracks MSCI World Index, you'll have zero representation, zero from India, because that's a developed market index. If you have MSCI All Country World, which includes emerging markets, you will have about 1%. So that is tiny. As I've said to you before, you know, 2% of that is in Australia. So you'll have more exposure back to your home market than you are getting to India. So over time, I think this is going to change. MSCI is not the fastest moving animal in the world. You know, it took 10, 15 years for China to get included. I think India, though, that will continue to, you know, that representation will continue to increase as the economy grows. And even in Asia, India is only 10%, so it's the second largest country. Mm-hmm. But because of the way MSCI rules work, you know, Korea and Taiwan both have larger representations. So if you want direct exposure to India, you need to go with a fund that does India. Mm-hmm. This is another thing. A lot of my peers in LIC land, they've decided India is all too hard and they don't do India at all. Wow. Or other funds in Australia, they've decided it's all too hard and they do fund of funds for their India part. Mm-hmm. So we think that India is the second largest economy in Asia, and in our universe, you've got to do it yourself. Yeah. You can't outsource that. So we spend a lot of time in India, and we're very confident that over time that representation is going to grow in the indices.
It's a very important question then. Any risks you see? There will be some on the horizon for investors who are thinking about going into this market?
Yeah. So one thing I will say, if you want to invest in countries like India, you do have to have a long-term view. This is not a market. People often ask me this about India and about China. Is now the time to dip my toe in? And I say, you know, these are going to be two of the three largest economies in the whole world in 10 years. This is not a dip my toe in, dip it back out, try to time things properly. They're growing. They're good economies. They're getting really big. Just stick your whole foot in and keep it there. So that said, there are risks coming up. One is obviously the election. That's next year. I guess the other is sort of a macro risk in terms of, you know, historically inflation has been a concern in India, and inflation has been a concern. Inflation has been kept really under wraps under the Modi government, but they have implemented this policy called the minimum sale price. It's for agricultural crops, and it's been a very healthy monsoon, this recent monsoon. And so if, you know, that inflation starts to trickle into the economy and they have to raise rates quite aggressively, that will dampen the cyclical story in India in the short term. I guess the other thing to keep an eye on is the oil price. So a lot of people don't know this, but India doesn't really have any domestic oil, so they are a major, they import 80% of the oil. Wow. And, you know, oil back down at this level is okay. When oil was up at 75 and some people were saying it's going back to 100, that's a concern for India. So those are the things that I would highlight. The election, potential inflation, and oil.
So one final question for you. You talked about the PEG ratio that you like to use. Where's India sitting relative to the Australian market?
No, so India is similar. India is around one times. But it's really important for investors to get their head around what buying a high PE stock in a high growth market means. Mm. So a lot of investors, even Australian funds that invest in India, often say that it's expensive. Mm. And what they mean is it's high PE. So the Indian market is trading around 22 times PE, which sounds high. But if it's growing at 20% growth, that's not that high on a PEG ratio. You're just over one times. And so, yeah, it's really important for investors to realize that if you're paying a high PE, you're often paying that because of the growth. And if that growth continues year after year after year, obviously what you're paying in terms of PE comes through. So just to give you the numbers, though, India is just over one time. Australia is around 3.8 times. So the price that you're paying for growth in Australia is way, way higher than what you're paying in India.
Hence our story about the growth opportunities there relative to the domestic market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mary, India comprises 20% of the Ellerston Asia LIC and of your unlisted fund as well. So for people who are listening who are trying to understand where it fits in your portfolio, 20%, is that likely to change at all?
No, so it's roughly around 17% now, a little bit less than 20, but that is quite a bit more than, as we said, than the benchmark weight. Mm. So I'm definitely overweight India. I've been anywhere up to around 30% in India, and Ellerston Asia is benchmark unaware. So that means that, you know, I can be as high or as low or as zero if I want in different country allocations. And I think that that's really important to be able to have that flexibility, because, you know, things change in Asia and you need to be able to rotate in and out of countries. I'm a long-term believer in the Indian story, and I've been overweight for you know, since inception.
Thank you so much. All of these insights are somewhat different to some of the things that we've been bringing to investors for a while, and I know they're going to be really keen to hear more of what you have to say, some of the more specific stories about stocks you have in your portfolio and where it's going over time. How can people keep up to date with the things that you bring to market?
Yeah, great. Thanks for asking. So you can go to the Ellerston Capital website. They're usually on the front page, and if it's more material that is somewhat dated, you can go to the Ellerston Asia page, and everything will be there. You can also contact me or connect with me via LinkedIn, put all our stuff on LinkedIn, or you can contact our investor relations, and they can send you any information that people would be interested in.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Your Wealth podcast. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.